Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Book Network podcast. I'm Deidre Tyler. Today, we'll be talking with two experts about vulnerable communities. I will let them introduce themselves to you, but the title of the book is Vulnerable Communities, Research, Policy, and Practice in Small Cities. Now for your introduction.
My name is Jim Connolly. I'm the director of the Center for Middletown Studies at Ball State University.
I'm Dagny Falk. I'm the director of research in the Center for Business and Economic Research at Ball State University.
Welcome to the podcast. I wonder if you could begin this interview by saying a few words about yourself and how you became interested in this topic.
Should I go first, Dagny?
Yeah, you should always go first. Let's just do it that way.
Okay, that'll keep it smooth. So I'm a historian by training, a historian of American cities. And so my research through most of my career has been focused on different aspects of American urban experience. One of those aspects is the history of smaller cities. And so I've worked on that in a variety of ways, organized conferences, various kinds of publications as well. And that's been one of my core research focuses over the last decade or so, particularly.
And I became interested in small cities because of Jim basically participating in a conference that he organized probably a decade ago now. And most of my work is in state and local public finance, and the chapter that I do in this book is on that topic. But I do some other work related to small cities and rural areas also more recently.
Now, the term vulnerable communities, can you describe to us what is a vulnerable community?
In my mind, the concept of a vulnerable community, and I guess I should pause for a moment and credit Emily Warnell, who is our colleague and collaborator, who is actually the person who proposed that term. And it became the theme of a conference that we organized in 2018. And out of that conference came this book, which is a collection of papers that have been revised since the conference, but were originally presented at the conference. And so the idea of vulnerable communities is, for our purposes, smaller places that have economic difficulties typically and that are still struggling in the 2020s, still facing specific sets of challenges. And we think there's a class of cities, smaller cities in the United States, that are in this position, both because they have limited political clout, but they also have a specific set or a common set of economic challenges that they face that are partly a result of their size.
Yeah, and the economic challenges are often related to dramatic decreases in manufacturing employment and population loss that's associated with that. And many of these communities tend to be in what's called the Rust Belt, which spans the Northeast through the Midwest, east of the Mississippi or so. But there are also, you know, other places like Bessemer, Alabama is one of the communities that is examined in this book.
Now, when you're looking at location, Does place matter in regards to the economic policies?
Yeah, a lot. I mean, a part of what we're trying to do with the book is not only talk about the reasons why these communities are struggling, but also to think about approaches that can be taken to address some of these difficulties. And when you're thinking about the approaches, that place really matters, right? Sort of the thing you have to do initially is to figure out, based on where you are, what kind of opportunities, what kinds of paths forward are available to you. So if you're located within hailing distance of a metropolitan center, then there's an opportunity to become a suburb, a bedroom community. If you're located near particular natural amenities, mountains, lakes, beaches, things like that, then there are obviously opportunities tied to those assets. In other cases, you know, and this is true for a lot of the cities in the middle of the country, you have fewer of those kinds of resources. So you have to think carefully about where you're located. Some smaller cities that have successfully moved ahead economically are beneficiaries of what some scholars have called place luck. Which is an opportunity that's available to them because of where they're located. So place certainly matters in that sense.
And then one of the topics that is discussed in one of the chapters of this book is whether a community is classified as part of a metropolitan area or not, or goes back and forth between metro and non-metro area depending on changes in the federal classification. That determines the type of funding and the programs that they're available to apply for funding, and reimbursement rates for things like community development block grants, depending on, you know, how they're classified.
Medicaid reimbursements, things like that as well.
Yes, yes.
Population growth. Give us the example of Harrisburg, Virginia, and what happened with that community.
So that is the first chapter in our book. It's a chapter by Henry Way from James Madison University. And he talks about Harrisonburg as a place that's done relatively well. In fact, if you survey the communities that are represented in this book, it's probably doing the best in economic terms. And he talks about the ways in which the city worked with the university, James Madison, which is located there. It was also the recipient of a significant influx of immigrants who've helped with and contributed to population growth. And it's also worked very hard to redevelop its downtown. And all of these things are positives. All these things are resources that the city has been able to use to grow and to do relatively well economically as a result. Despite that fact, because it's a smaller place, it's not a large city, it struggles with or has to deal with what Henry calls in-betweenness, right? It's got some attributes of a big city, but it's not a big city, and it has some things that are distinctive in its smallness. Henry is a planner, and what he really focuses on is the ways in which the influx of immigrants, the growth of the university, and the development of the downtown have not been coordinated, and that is in some ways limited the city's growth, and that there are opportunities for more and better growth with greater coordination in those areas.
Good job. I don't have anything to add on that.
You know, what happens when an industry leaves a small town and that small town is left without jobs? The example you gave in the book was Alabama. Tell us about that area.
Bessemer, Alabama, is featured in one of the chapters by Bill Holt at Birmingham Southern College. And he talks about the history of that city as well as the more recent redevelopment efforts. And it's a city that's been in the news lately. There has been a union drive at the recently opened Amazon distribution center there that's captured a lot of national attention, is still ongoing. The conflict is still there. And what Bill really does is show us how, first of all, the loss of industry, particularly the steel industry in the case of Bessemer, has really decimated the community. It's also a majority Black community, which gives it another set of complicated issues and challenges facing the community. There's a history of discrimination and segregation, and the city suffers from the fact that it's a majority minority community. as well. And it's been working very hard, and it's really applied many of the different things in the economic redevelopment playbook. Luring stores, trying to redevelop certain parts of downtown. It's really struggled to do that. And it is perhaps making some headway, landing not only the Amazon Distribution Center, but several others as well. But the conflicts you see between Amazon's workers and the company that are in the national news and have been lately, really show the difficulty of reviving a place like that, that faces the twin challenges of industrial job loss and the legacies of racial discrimination.
Now, when we look at small cities, we see that they are really dependent on federal programs such as SNAP, Social Security, et cetera.
Right.
So, I mean, when those programs are not available and people leave, what type of situation would that bring about?
That too is addressed in one of the chapters in our book, chapter by Alan Mollick, where he really emphasizes the role that what he calls transfer payments sustain a lot of these places that would otherwise be struggling. So a city like Johnstown, Pennsylvania, is highly dependent on distributions through SNAP, Medicaid and Medicare payments that sustain the hospital there, which is one of the major employers. Other cities rely heavily on public universities that have student bodies that receive large amounts of federal assistance through loan programs. So they're really kept afloat by these urban transfer payments and might not be sustainable otherwise, don't seem to be sustainable otherwise. And so we need to think carefully about how we can, perhaps wean some of these communities off of that dependence and push them towards becoming more economically sustainable. As Alan points out, there's a lot of these people, and we can just let these cities wither, but that creates all kinds of other issues about what happens to the millions of people who live in these kinds of places.
So you talked about bringing in a place for people to work. That's one way to help the population. What are some other ways that help cities grow?
Well, bringing in work is an interesting topic. One of our contributions is from our colleague, Mike Hicks, and he talks about the pros and cons of that. And I'm going to let Dagny talk about that because I think she has more to say.
Yeah, and traditionally, in economic development, the focus has been on attracting firms, but the jobs that are associated with that and the multiplier effects that are associated with that. In Mike's work, he shows that these multiplier effects of attracting large firms have decreased over time, and that there's an asymmetry in that the economic impact of losing a firm is much greater in terms of the overall employment loss than the economic impact of gaining a new plant in a location. So that begs the question of, maybe we should be thinking a little differently about economic development, that it's not just attracting a new manufacturing plant. And the focus has shifted a bit in economic development to focus on quality of place and making places attractive so that people want to live there, so that you're not just focusing on attracting employees and employment opportunities, but you're also focusing on attracting households. And yep. In this day and age, and we don't cover this in the book, but with people being able to work remotely, there's a lot more opportunity for people to live, outside of urban areas and work, wherever.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I would add to that is that a number of the chapters in the book talk about in various ways the necessity of developing communities' civic capacity. Colleen DeWicke is one of our contributors from the Federal Reserve Bank in Boston, and they run a program in New England that attempts to develop civic capacity, the ability of communities to act in cohesive ways, coordinated ways, to pursue economic redevelopment. And that's ongoing, but it's showing real signs of being beneficial, that before you even worry about trying to bring in a company That you have to have communities that are functioning well in a civic sense. And her research shows how that can be a really effective way to position communities to capitalize on the opportunities that they have.
Now, in your book, you talk about Cleveland, Ohio. Mm-hmm. What are some of the problems that are going on there?
So there's a chapter by Hannah Leibovitz from UTexas Arlington about Cleveland. What she really looks at is the suburbs immediately surrounding Cleveland. And these are a set of inner ring communities where she analyzes their master plans, their core planning documents to sort of figure out what are they doing? How are they thinking about themselves as communities? How do they define themselves as communities? And what's interesting is she finds that they really think of themselves as independent from Cleveland in a way that you wouldn't expect of suburbs. You know, sort of the typical expectation is that's one of the advantages that a suburban location would have, even a once industrial community near a larger city would have, is that they could become satellites of the major city. But in the case of Cleveland, where the core city isn't doing all that well economically, these cities are striving to distinguish themselves from the central city and to define themselves as independent places, as small cities, even though they are located, you know, immediately adjacent to a major metropolitan center.
Now, another question that your book talks about is property taxes. When they are reduced because of population loss, what happens in that environment?
Yeah, this is the chapter that I co-authored along with Chip Taylor and Pam Shaw, where we look at the impact of recently imposed property tax rate caps in Indiana and how that affects the functioning of small cities within the state. And we look at how, or the two possibilities that local governments have for adjusting to these revenue losses are either decreasing their budgets and associated employment, or increasing revenue from some other source, which in Indiana, those sources are very limited. It's either a local option income tax or annexation in order to increase the property tax base. And we find that this revenue loss from property tax caps has had a variable effect, and that some small cities have been affected dramatically, losing as much as 30% of their property tax revenues, and other cities, it's been much lower, like around 3%. And then that local governments, municipalities have adjusted by decreasing their budgets and decreasing employment. And the type of employment tends to be in parks and recreation and highway, police and fire, the public safety services tend to be more protected. For the short time period that we looked at, we found that up to that time, local municipalities had not increased their local option income tax rates or engaged in noticeable annexation, although there have been increases in local option income tax rates.
Now, there were places that were doing really well, and Lawrence, Massachusetts had a decline in population, but they are turning things around. Tell us about that chapter.
That's discussed in the chapter by Colleen DeWicke about building civic capacity in these communities. And so Lawrence is an example of a place where they're making progress and that there is evidence that turnaround that's becoming visible is at least in part made possible by the fact that they've brought together stakeholders from across the community, representatives of various neighborhoods, organizations, social groups, as well as institutions, and that they've kind of coordinated amongst each other and developed a level of trust with each other that's enabling the city to start to make progress. And so this is where we try to get into in the book. This is not a book that's sort of got full policy prescriptions or anything like that, but what we try to do is to present ways in which people who are interested in the fate of these kinds of communities can think strategically. And so we're pushing people away from the idea that you want to go out and chase smokestacks, recruit new businesses to bring people in. Because as Dagny was saying, Mike Hicks's work really shows that that's a long-term loser. Instead, you want to develop the civic capacity, the amenities, the attractiveness of these communities. In a place like Lawrence, you're starting to see some of that happen. So there are sort of green shoots in these kinds of places that point us towards placemaking, as Dagny mentioned a moment ago, towards building civic capacity, and towards thinking creatively about how to develop the community rather than simply thinking about how to attract employers.
Another really interesting thing in your book was about the population diversity and how things were changing very rapidly for the areas of Fargo, North Dakota, and Sioux Falls. Tell us about that story. I found that to be really interesting.
So one of the strategies, in addition to the things I was just talking about a moment ago, one of the strategies that a number of communities have begun to adopt is to recruit refugees or to attract immigrants to settle in these communities. There's even national discussions about creating federal incentives that would encourage immigrants and refugees to move into the heartland, into this more struggling parts of the country, the Midwest, the Rust Belt, particularly. And so Jen Erickson, who is our colleague here at Ball State, has done a lot of ethnographic research about Fargo, North Dakota, amongst other places. And what they're finding is that this is an example of a community that has begun to, but has been in the business of bringing in refugees as one of the things that contributes to their growth. There's other things that really benefit cities in the Dakotas, particularly the natural gas boom in that area. But one of the strategies they've adopted is attracting refugees. And what Jen shows is that simply wanting to bring refugees in is not the same thing as actually bringing them in, settling them, integrating them into the community, and receiving the economic benefits that they bring. And so she sort of lays out policies for different or ideas and approaches for different parts of local government. So for instance, you want to have police and other public officials who are familiar with the language and culture of the newcomers, particularly the culture of the newcomers. You want to find ways to make these people fit into the community in a way that, again, makes these communities cohesive and in a position to capitalize on the opportunities that they have. And so refugee attraction is a key strategy, but it's also one that comes with not just bring them in, but also help them adjust, help them integrate into the community.
Now, this was dealt with in one of your chapters about drawing younger people into smaller cities. What's going on with the research there?
I mean, there's a broader, and Dagny, you can weigh in here if you have other things to add, but there's a broader argument, and this is across several of the chapters, that you want to bring in, you want to attract people. You want to retain the people that you have, and that you should think in people first terms about how to redevelop these communities rather than think about chasing businesses and trying to land new employers. So the community we live in now recently is completing a project that will employ over 300 workers in, I think it's a canning operation. And that's great for 300 workers, but this is a community we're talking about that once employed 3,000 workers in a factory. So bringing in 300 new workers is a good thing, but it doesn't solve the problem or compensate for the loss of 3,000 jobs. And so simply pursuing manufacturing opportunities isn't enough. You want to bring in other people, often younger people, college-educated people, into these communities, and you want to design them in ways that are attractive to those kinds of groups. Again, this is about encouraging population growth in these places.
Yeah, one of the issues is brain drain, and that younger people tend to leave communities for, especially after they've gone to college, in order to pursue other career opportunities. So having a place, quality of place, so that younger people want to live in smaller cities and rural areas is important. And that feeds into immigrants too. I mean, the immigrants have low levels of education, but a lot of immigrants also that have very high levels of education, you know, and work in the sciences or medical professions, and being able to attract highly educated immigrants, you know, is an economic development strategy for small cities and rural areas.
One nugget that I found in your book that I thought was really interesting was the election of 2020. It gave us more information, especially about population change and how things have changed in terms of poverty in the suburban areas. Tell us more about that.
So one of the things that both the 2016 and the 2020 elections did was focus attention on the kinds of places that we're writing about in this book. And there's connections that are being made between the dissatisfactions we're seeing in the Midwest, in parts of the American South, that were expressed, frankly, through support for Donald Trump, that where people connect those kinds of that kind of discontent and the political difficulties it's creating in the country, and the drift away from democracy that we're seeing, and the economic condition of these places. And so recent elections have really trained our attention on these issues as it's more than just about economic performance. Ultimately, it's also about our civic health as a nation and our civic health in specific communities. And so there are other scholars who are particularly focused on, not just in the United States even, but also other communities in similar positions around the world. You know, their economic health is closely tied to the civic condition of these societies, including our society.
What is the overall message you would like to leave your reader with after they read this book?
I have a couple things, but Dagny, do you want to weigh in on what you might want to say are the big takeaways?
Well, one is that we want to bring a focus to smaller cities and vulnerable communities in general, and some of the problems and policies that have been implemented to try and improve these places, and practical suggestions also. So we want to provide some information and then maybe some strategies that policymakers can think about and perhaps implement.
Right, and push beyond the let's get more businesses, let's land more businesses for our towns. There's really kind of, you know, we don't, as I said, we're not a book that's filled with specific policy prescriptions because there's no one size fits all model for these places. You know, you have a southern community like Bessemer, right. Alabama is a lot different from an inner ring suburb in outside of Cleveland, Ohio, or a small city in Indiana, or other kinds of similar places. So we want to sort of get people to think in at least two ways about the challenges that these communities face and how these can be addressed. One of these is to think about the internal dynamics of these places. They're smaller, they're not metropolitan centers, but they're still cities. So they still have diversity, they still have conflicts, they still have tensions and specific histories around some of these tensions. And so we want the people who are interested in reviving these places to go into the process aware of that and looking for that. We have a nice epilogue to the book by Greg Goodnight, who's the former mayor of Kokomo, Indiana, who's had great success in working towards redeveloping that city. And he describes all the conflicts, the tensions when he knew he was doing the right thing in terms of what policymakers or policy scholars would recommend, but it still created all kinds of friction and tension. And he lays that out really nicely and gives us an appreciation of the fact that there are these kinds of political divisions and conflicts that are going to arise as you pursue these redevelopment policies. And you can't just sort of go in and assume that these small cities are, because they're small, cohesive and can act on policy prescriptions in a quick and straightforward manner. And the other thing we really want people to be aware of is that there are real structural disadvantages at the state and national level for smaller cities. Cities in the United States are generally weaker than they are in many other countries. They are creations of state governments. They're given charters by state governments. So the state governments can dictate how they behave. They can limit whether or not they can, you know, change the local minimum wage. They can get into, you know, the gender politics that are so intense right now and restrict the ability of cities to accommodate people from, you know, with different kinds of characteristics.
They can impose property tax caps that dramatically affect
right. Yeah, they can limit the ability of cities
without really much input. Go ahead.
Right. Sorry. Yeah, they can limit, as Dagny was saying, they can limit the ability of cities to raise money or to annex or not annex of this. And then on top of that, of course, small cities are less powerful economically than big cities. Just there's less going on. They're smaller. So that combination of governmental restrictions, policy restrictions, political restrictions, economic, lesser economic capacity than you see in big cities, has made these communities particularly vulnerable. So as people start to think about what to do about it, we want them to think, all right, what's going on inside these places? And what are the larger structural challenges that they face? And what can we do perhaps in these broader terms? Can we adjust state policies? Can we adjust federal policies to put these cities in a better position? So it's really those two things I would say are the big takeaways.
Well, I've taken up enough of your time. Can you tell me what's the next projects you will be working on?
One of the things that happened with this book is that we did most of the work before COVID hit. And so I'm interested in finding out, the next chapter in terms of the impact of the pandemic and all of the restrictions and permutations. Dagny talked earlier about the work from home, the shift to work from home and remote work. What's that going to do for these places? There are cities right now that are working very hard in this part of the country to recruit.
Remote workers.
Yeah, exactly.
They're paying money.
Yeah, how's that going to work out? And, how does that perhaps change these approaches? So that's one thing I'm interested in. There's other topics. I think in general, these smaller communities have not received as much research as metropolitan places have. And so we want to promote that.
And we're just finishing a study of rural Indiana that we will be published the next few weeks, where we look at different aspects of the rural areas, housing, employment, the manufacturing sector. It's like a dozen different topics. So that part of this, that's one of the results of this work, is that it spurred us to do some additional work on smaller places.
Well, thank you. Anything else you'd like to say?
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. The book is published by Cornell University Press, so you can find it online and in through various bookstores. So we'd encourage you to have a look.
Yeah. And the title again is Vulnerable Communities. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.